Welcome to How Did You Think of That? My name is Temple Grandin, Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University.
And I'm Sherry Quinn, continuing our two-part series on Great Salt Lake, John Luft, Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program Manager with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, talks to Temple Grandin about the division's longtime monitoring of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem and its successes working with the lake's brine shrimp industry. First, we hear from wildlife biologist and self-proclaimed Great Salt Lake nerd, Jamie Butler. She explains how the industry approached the division and the state of Utah in a somewhat unusual request, one for oversight.
I read your bio, Temple, and you talked about these labels that were like weird, that you were maybe a weird kid, or
well,
that you
a weird kid.
Or that you had these expectations put on you. And I feel like the lake is that too. I think the lake is kind of a weird place. Like
well,
when you go in,
it's a weird place. It is. But the
yeah.
thing is, I'm learning. I had no idea this lake was feeding fish, farmed fish, all around the world. And this is kind of a mind blower. And I think this is where you can really get the attention. If you destroy this resource, think of the amount of fish you will not be able to feed, because right now it's a renewable resource. But if you wreck it, then you no longer have a renewable resource for feeding fish.
And you know how cool this industry is? This industry actually asked to be managed in the mid-1990s. The brine shrimp industry came to the state of Utah and the Division of Natural Resources and said, hey, we think we're over-harvesting. Could you please manage us? And the division started doing that. And the cool thing was, so they started this permit system with the brine shrimp harvesters where they had to like pay X amount of dollars to harvest brine shrimp. And the state put all of that money into studying Great Salt Lake and doing like the fundamental ecological research on the lake. And so it's this really like interesting, cool model of adaptive management. So they don't manage based on like how much they can take out. They manage based on how much brine shrimp is in Great Salt Lake at that particular time. And then all of that money goes into understanding the ecology of Great Salt Lake. And I think it's a really like beautiful model of sustainable ecosystem management with cooperation of industry.
Wildlife biologist John Luft has a long history with Great Salt Lake. He's managed its ecosystem for decades, and a big part of that job includes overseeing the brine shrimp industry and ensuring healthy populations of these tiny aquatic crustaceans. He joins Temple to talk about the brine shrimp and their global importance, but also the division's work on ensuring a thriving Great Salt Lake ecosystem that millions of migratory shorebirds depend on to survive. They also delve into many of the intricacies of trying to maintain healthy natural ecosystems amidst the needs and sometimes mistakes of modern societies.
So I've worked at the Great Salt Lake for over 20 years. I actually have worked in one capacity or another, either on or around Great Salt Lake. I've worked at the waterfowl management areas, both at Farmington Bay and Ogden Bay. And then I was the avian biologist on the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program here. And then I became the manager and have been that for about 15 years or so now. And basically what we do is manage the brine shrimp fishery. So this is one of the only places, probably the main place in North America, that there's a commercial brine shrimp fishery, and it still supplies 40 to 50% of the worldwide demand for brine shrimp. And so it's one of the few places that conservation and industry have come together and been able to mutually work together for the same purpose. And they are important to us and help us manage the brine shrimp fishery so that we have enough available for the birds. And so we use them to kind of maximize the productivity on Great Salt Lake.
I just want to make sure I understand that the main market for the brine shrimp is to feed farmed fish.
Yep, that's correct. That's So originally, and you probably remember back in the day when in the back of the comic books, you would get sea monkeys.
That was how it originally
started that way. And eventually in the 90s, I would say probably in the early 90s, you could have, if you would have bought or eaten shrimp at a restaurant, it would have been caught out of the ocean. Now, probably most shrimp or the majority of the shrimp that people eat are grown in those aquaculture industries. And brine shrimp is an important food source for growing the shrimp.
The Salt Lake is 40 or 50% of the brine shrimp market. Who's providing the other 50% or 40%?
Yeah, so it's become more competitive. It used to be about 90 to 95% of the worldwide demand was supplied by Great Salt Lake. So now other parts of the world, China, Russia, all have become more competitive. And some of the Russian countries like Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan, they are able to provide more brine shrimp than they used to, mostly by copying what Great Salt Lake has done.
Great Salt Lake's really unique. Are they growing the brine shrimp artificially? Or
no, there are some places that are close to the ocean where they do kind of grow brine shrimp in kind of artificial ponds adjacent to
somewhat of an artificial system, where if my understanding is the Great Salt Lake is a natural system.
Right.
And what Russia or some other country would have to do is make some kind of an aquaculture type of sort of thing to grow them.
Right.
Okay.
So, and the thing is this is the brine shrimp here at Great Salt Lake. It's Artemia franciscana. It's a lot of times it's a different species than some of the other brine shrimp in these other countries. So it's a different product basically. But they do have natural lakes that they're getting their brine shrimp from.
Let's say I'm raising seafood that needs brine shrimp. If I buy from a Great Salt Lake or I buy my feed from one of these other things, is there any difference in the quality of the feed?
Yeah, absolutely. So typically and when you talk about quality, what's harvested is the brine shrimp eggs. So it's the cysts, they dry those. So it looks like powder, the eggs do, and they can those. And so the biggest benefit to buying Great Salt Lake egg is it hatches typically at about 90% hatch rate, whereas these other countries and the other types of egg that you're getting from them usually hatches at about a 50% rate. So you have to buy twice as much of this other egg as you would Great Salt Lake egg. So that's why.
But then what's the price difference? See, I've just got to look at, I'm going to look at it just like I'd look at cattle, cost of gain.
Right. Yeah.
I have to buy feed. Look, I'm going to say I'm running aquaculture right now, and I'm, you know, working with my feed buyer right now. And I'm just trying to understand the whole thing here because I try to get into root causes of problems. Okay. Even though the product that's not Salt Lake is probably inferior product, I have to buy twice as much of it. But if it's cheap enough, I could buy twice as much of it.
Right. And that's the thing is if you want to pay half as much for a different product, but you buy twice as much, where is the breakover point? Obviously, that's the marketing part of, you know, what the industry deals with.
Well, it looks like, let's say, I mean, I want to preserve the Great Salt Lake, but let's say I'm the fish farmer and I could no longer get Salt Lake product. I still have another source of feed.
Oh, yeah.
Aquaculture is not going to go away if they can't get Salt Lake product.
Right, right.
Okay, so when I look at it in the whole world of things, fish farming can survive just fine without Salt Lake product.
Right, and I'm sure there's a limit to what is produced because Great Salt Lake is so big that, like I say, 40 to 50% of the worldwide demand comes from Great Salt Lake. So these other countries they might build up a surplus of product that they can have. But if Great Salt Lake collapsed, you're looking at people probably spending twice as much on some of those other feeds as they would normally too. So it's just a major global player in the aquaculture industry.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just like anything, you know, you have a resource, whether it's oil or whatever, you've got a whole bunch of it. Yeah, you control the market.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
Just like all the things on the periodic table of the elements go into electronics and batteries,
yeah.
Lithium, stuff like that. It's the same sort of thing. Now, of course, your other reason for preserving it is wildlife and the conservation site.
Right. That's the balance is what we want to do is to try to make sure that what is left out there helps feed the birds ultimately, as we want to make sure that we're not collapsing the ecosystem. If you don't pay attention to history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Oh, yes. I'm fully, yes.
So and that's true. I actually think there's a flip side to that, which is if you do pay attention to history, you might be able to duplicate it. And by that, I mean, the facility that we're at right now is at Ogden Bay. It was funded by Pittman Robertson money. It was the first, and Pittman Robertson is an excise tax on hunting and
What is this facility that was funded? Explain to me what that is.
So Ogden Bay is a waterfowl management area. Okay. And so it was put into place in the 30s because of all of the botulism outbreaks that were occurring along this river delta. And so to be able to control the water, it would help mitigate some of those botulism outbreaks. That is a success story instigated by Pittman and Robertson. That's
why it's called. You also had something where people just die.
What's that?
It's sort of like you have, necessity is the mother of invention. Just like we made vaccines really fast using RNA technology, which nobody was going to put money into because they never thought they could get through the regulatory hurdles. And then we had the emergency, and all of a sudden those regulatory hurdles to mRNA disappeared. And on the Moderna vaccine, for example, the lady who worked on that, she'd had like 8 grant applications turned down until she met the right doctor in the copier room. This is why we need to go back to the office. And they made the Moderna vaccine. But you also had this huge emergency, botulism. You're going to have people dying all over the place. That's why something got done about it quickly.
Right. And the thing is that money was available to anybody in the country. But here in Utah was the first place that they were able to put it in place and make a difference. Same thing happened. The Utah legislature in the 20s. Appropriated money for the Utah Fish and Game to start public shooting grounds, the first ever public wetlands purchased by the state, the Fish and Game. Our brine shrimp industry is another good example. It could have been an opportunity to exploit the resource, yet the industry came and said they did not want to see this ecosystem collapse because they wanted a sustainable fishery.
Well, yeah,
and so I think what I'm getting at is each time this occurred, and I'm just giving you examples in Utah, each time that occurred, it took a few individuals to spearhead that effort. Pittman and Robertson, Dingell Johnson Act, or Aldo Leopold or George Bird Grinnell, all were individuals that met a lot of resistance and pushed it through. The same thing is occurring with the Great Salt Lake. We've been so spoiled thinking that we had so much water, it was inexhaustible. Same with the wildlife in the early 1900s. Yeah. Oh, there's so much wildlife. There's nothing we can do to destroy it. And people saw that we were destroying it and that it needed to be regulated. And somebody had to actually step out and do that and actually made a difference. The same has to be done here with the Great Salt Lake is we can watch it go away or we can spearhead efforts.
One of the ways Luft and his colleagues are monitoring the Great Salt Lake ecosystem is through collecting data, lots of it. Luft explains their bioenergetics study.
I think really, as the Division of Wildlife, our job is to educate and inform and utilize the best data that's available to inform policymakers and legislators, what the impacts of lack of water is going to be, and then let them decide how best to implement any options that they have. So I would say that the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program in the last 30 years has been managing the brine shrimp fishery in cooperation with industry and utilizing them. That has been a good example of a success story. And a lot of that is because we have the data to support how to manage this system. And the way that that's been done is we try to maximize the productivity of the brine shrimp population through harvest. And there is a threshold that we try to reach every year to make sure that we are making sure that there's the most available food for the birds. That, I think, has been successful just in looking at eared grebes. We used to get an average of maybe a million grebes before the brine shrimp management was in place, and now we get 4 to 5 million eared grebes here, and I think that's because we've made sure that there isn't the big population fluctuations prior to the harvest. So now with the bioenergetic study, I'm hoping that we're going to move away from the pelagic portions of the lake, which I think we have a really good grasp on, and move out to the peripheries where, even though the Great Salt Lake is 50% of what it used to be, the impact is even more so because the edges, the wetlands, and the bays, we've lost probably 75% or more of that habitat. So with this bioenergetic study, the thing that I would like to see happen is for us to assess, what are those losses due to the habitat? What are the losses in forage? Because the birds come here for one reason, and that's to get refueled, get food. So how do we know we don't have any way, or we haven't had a way to quantify what food is available in the wetlands? And is there a way to maximize the productivity of these wetlands? It's all about efficiency. Just like with people and their lawns, can you be more efficient? Don't water when it's raining. Don't water when it's snowing. Grow something that's more drought tolerant.
Now, what sort of things have you actually done to improve the efficiency?
Right. So, and that's the thing, is individuals have done things. One of the things that we did here at our waterfowl management areas is we reduced the level of water in our ponds, or dried some up altogether to get water out to Great Salt Lake. There's a balance there because you're losing habitat for the birds in some of these wetlands, but we tried to look at how we could best impact the lake and the bays by still drying out some of our wetlands. And we were able to conserve about 40,000 acre feet. The Division of Wildlife manages 9 different waterfowl management areas, is what they're called. And so we were able to conserve this year about 40,000 acre feet of water that we were able to push to Great Salt Lake. Now, is that going to have a huge impact on the lake level? No, but it is something.
No, it's something. But it's something worth doing. See, I'm just trying to figure out what we can do in the future. If it keeps losing capacity, eventually it's going to go away.
Right. And that's why I say you can't make more water, but you can be more efficient with the water that you do
have. Well, that's right.
That's the focus of this bioenergetic study, to help us help inform us.
Yeah.
How can we best use the water that we do have to maximize aquatic invertebrates, aquatic vegetation to feed these birds, because that's what they're here for. water banking, which would allow us to distribute water at different times, which may be critical for some species of birds during the course of their migration. So this project is to help assess what we are providing for birds, and are we short on what we're providing, and can we do a better job of distributing water at different times of the year to grow invertebrates for shorebirds, basically, or aquatic vegetation for waterfowl, depending on what we don't have available. And then to match that up with the flyway, the Pacific flyway timeframe for the different migration for the different species. So I don't know if that's kind of a nutshell description of what we're trying to do with that, because
in other words, what you're doing is improving the efficiency of what you've got right now, which is definitely something worth doing, absolutely worth doing. But what I'm thinking about is how to prevent further shrinkage where you just have a salt mud hole left. Things like aquifers being drained. Like in the 70s, for example, in the Middle East, they started using center pivot sprinklers of aquifers in the desert. That's all been drained. And the only way they can get hay to feed their cows, their dairy cows, is to grow it in California. I've seen a place where they do this, pack it in shipping containers and ship it over there. That's something not very sustainable. Some of the aquifers, like in the sand hills, replenish better, and others don't. It's the same old problem with all the stuff on the periodic table of the elements that goes into electronics, where you're using up a resource. We can't make things that are on the periodic table of the elements.
Right.
That much chemistry I do know.
Yeah, this water optimization effort with the agricultural community, they're seeing the benefits of that already. And
oh,
I think
good.
That the farmers that have been converting their property, kind of like you said, you lose a lot of water on those center pivot or sprinkler systems.
I've seen this in the 70s. There was a rainbird sprinkler on the top spraying up in the air on the center pivot.
Yeah.
Nobody has that now.
Right.
That thing that comes down with a drop.
Right.
Where it's you know, 2 foot above the ground and putting the water out. People are already doing that to conserve water. And this is the thing. It's, you know, sort of like more and more users fighting around a smaller and smaller water hole.
Yeah. Well, and there's a balance too. Drip irrigation is great for some things. Flood irrigation is also beneficial for birds here. I mean, yeah, there's been studies that have been done for like ibis that frequent these fields here. We have one of the largest breeding colonies for white-faced ibis here. And so some of the agricultural practices here are hugely beneficial for birds because it provides more habitat. It's just making the best use of your water so you're not just spitting it up in the air.
You don't want to be spitting it up in the air. That's something you definitely don't want to be doing.
Right.
See, the other thing that's a problem on a lot of this problem solving is people don't see the problem coming, because I can remember when Saudi Arabia, for example, first put in center pivots, and there were pictures published in our farm magazines of, oh, they're making the desert bloom. Well, that's not happening now. They've totally drained the aquifer. You can look on the maps of the world. I'm thinking about it strictly in what would be the things you could do. Okay, here's where flood irrigation was beneficial.
Yeah.
Where it was actually beneficial. Okay, if you're trying to figure out what to do, then maybe I don't ban all flood irrigation.
Right, exactly.
I might use it where it's beneficial. And the other places, I got to stop it.
Yeah, and that's I think that speaks to the whole efficiency thing.
And what crop is the flood of the ibises? What crop are they flood irrigating where it really works for the ibises?
Usually alfalfa.
Alfalfa, yep. Mm-hmm. The big water pig of a crop.
At least that's where I see all the ibis.
Okay, all right. Well, that's... You're actually kind of making a wetland for the ibis.
Yeah, ibis and cattle egret. And yeah, because they're out there foraging on the invertebrates that surface when that water is put on. You know, you talk about Saudi Arabia and some of these other countries like Lake Permaya and that's in Iran and the Aral Sea next to Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. Those are examples of how not to do things.
We probably need to be figuring out, you know, cheaper ways to desalinize seawater, you know, hydrogen fuels. I read a lot of this magazine called Chemical and Engineering News. I call it chemistry for suits. In other words, the people that are going to be managing this stuff, things where, you know, we ought to be investing in.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. We at least have an example of how not to do things. And I have, and that's why I was mentioning how Utah has managed to step up over its history and meet some of these challenges. Don't ignore them until it's disaster.
That's good.
Yeah.
And I learned something today that alfalfa fields actually can make artificial wetlands for ibises.
Yeah.
You see, now when you say that, I see it.
Yeah, and a lot of Utah, we sustain ourselves. We have a lot of fruit crops, and, you know, we have a lot of farms and cattle and things like that. So we're more self-sustained.
Well, then we looked at the whole issue of cattle, and I wrote a paper recently on grazing. Cattle, sheep, and goats are an important part of sustainable agricultural future. Because you have a lot of land where grazing is the only way you can raise food on. You can raise food on sand hills in Nebraska unless you graze it. If you do grazing wrong, it wrecks land. If you do it right, it improves land. And grazing cattle or sheep or goats or even bison as a crop rotation every third year, then you can cut down on the end fertilizer, you know, the artificial fertilizer you have to use. And so there's a place there for animal agriculture. Shipping containers full of alfalfa going over to another country as backhauls for electronics. It gives them a backhaul, but there's nothing very sustainable about that.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that we've been doing here, when you mentioned cattle and stuff, we have an invasive weed here on all throughout the Wasatch Front, all the wetlands here. It's called Phragmites, and it does consume a lot of water. But we've managed to get cattle grazing on a lot of our waterfowl management areas to help control that Phragmites, and that's been a huge aid in increasing the good bird habitat.
Well, we're seeing two things. Everyone says, you know, everything with big ag is terrible. Now, we've just seen how big ag's alfalfa field done right makes habitat. We can take cattle and get rid, or sheep or some goats will eat all kinds of rubbish and use it to improve that habitat. Animals are part of the land. Grazing animals are part of the land. And I've been in the cattle industry for 50 years, and I spent 50 years of my career working with an animal. We ought to just get rid of them. And where I think livestock actually can do good is on the, from the grazing things. You just told me about how you're taking an alfalfa field, make a wetland out of it, but then you've got taking grazing animals and get rid of an invasive plant. See, that's integrating plants and animals together.
Yep.
That kind of thinking is the kind of thinking I really like, but I've also been reading a lot of stuff about monoculture stuff like palm oil plantations. Read an interesting article on selective logging. If that's done right, you can actually improve the environment. You do it wrong, it's terrible, completely terrible. It's just like overgrazing. But the grazing animal is part of the land. And, you know, there's things that we don't have to change. But, you know, people will complain that cattle take up more land than other livestock. But 20% of the Earth's habitable surface can only be grazed. And that's a conservative estimate. And I'd rather keep it as a very conservative estimate. I've seen up to 40%. I don't believe that. I'd rather go with a lower estimate.
You know, I grew up in Kansas, so it's a farming and ranching state. And just knowing and seeing people who pay attention to the land, farming and ranching is a lot more complicated than most people think it is.
I appreciate that. But you're just giving me some very interesting things where the place where you're actually making bird habitat, flood irrigated alfalfa.
It all works together. I mean, there's the ability to adapt and use what is available makes a huge difference.
And that concludes our series, Messages of Great Salt Lake.
Great being here, and I've just I've learned some things today too. Some really interesting things today.
Thank you so much, Temple.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center in partnership with SQ Media.
Thank you so much for listening.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grants number 174-5674.